Okay, it's a pleasure to be here to give this talk in an audience that thought a lot about black holes. So I'll start with some general introduction that many of you will be very familiar with. So defining questions in gravity for the last 80 years have been the following. First of all, why does a black hole have entropy which is proportional to its horizon area? Is there information loss because of black holes? And how does one resolve space-time singularities such as those inside black holes or in big microcosmologies? Now recently, the ADS-EFT correspondence motivated a new idea in black hole physics, the Fassbury proposal, which if true would resolve, would provide answers to this to these questions, and this is going to be the topic of this talk. But to start smoothly, I will start in giving you a little bit of a longer introduction about these issues, and then we'll see how the Fassbury proposal comes in. So okay, so let's start from the beginning. So about 30, 40 years ago, it was established that the laws of black hole mechanics are remarkably analogous to the laws of thermodynamics, with the area of the horizon being the entropy and the surface gravity being the curvature. And the discovery of, by Hawking a little bit later, that black holes thermally radiate showed that this is more than an analogy. And as always in physics, if we see thermodynamics, we think that there might be some statistical mechanical explanation behind that behavior. Black holes, however, appear to be unique. So it seems so if we have a system that has a big classical phase space, then we think that the entropy arises by quantizing this classical phase space, but black holes basically appear as if they have a zero-dimensional phase space. So it doesn't seem to be room for a conventional explanation. But if we accept that the actual microstates are purely quantum mechanical, we still have a puzzle because the entropy appears to be proportional to the area of the horizon rather than the volume that the black hole occupies, as one might have anticipated based on the fact that the entropy is an extensive quantity. So based on this, it appears that there is no room for conventional statistical mechanical description. But things are even worse because very simple arguments they simply imply that even the dynamics of the microstates is not unitary. These arguments are based on Hawking radiation. So for example, we can have a few states which falls into a black hole, but only thermal radiation comes out, so it appears as if few states involve a unique state, thus violating unitarity. So these issues have been debated hotly over the last 30 years, and I think it's fair to say that this leaves little doubt that the solution would involve some new physics in unexpected ways. So what we will see, we'll indeed see that the solution which the Fassbury proposal gives, it does involve some new physics. It actually involves a new physical principle, the holographic principle. And the underlying picture for the quantum black hole, although very natural within the setup of holography, is drastically different than anticipated in earlier works. So the holographic principle precisely derives from things from black holes and states that any d plus one dimensional gravitational theory should have a description in terms of d-dimensional quantum field theory, but now without gravity. So a celebrated example of a holographic theory comes in using the ADS-EFT correspondence. And as we will discuss in this talk, the ADS-EFT correspondence implies that essentially a form of the Fassbury proposal must hold. So this is going to be the main point of this talk. So the Fassbury proposal was gradually formulated in the works of Mathurin collaborators in the period between 2000 and 2004, and its status after 2005 was reviewed in this paper. But this talk is going to be based mostly on three papers I wrote last year with Mike Catero and our student, and especially on a physics report that we currently finishing. So here's the outline of the talk. This was my kind of long introduction. So I will start and I will define what the Fassbury proposal is. Then I will discuss how the Fassbury proposal would address black hole puzzles. And then I will move on to discuss the relation between ADS-EFT and the Fassbury proposal. So this is going to be, in a sense, a long introduction to what the Fassbury is, and this is going to culminate into setting some key questions that would be crucial to answer in order to verify whether this picture makes sense. So now I'm going to move to the second part of the talk. I mean, this is going to be, in a sense, at least one third of the talk, where I'm going to discuss in quite some detail how to use holography in order to probe these questions. And then after that, we're going to move back to become very concrete and discuss explicit examples of puzzles. And this is going to be examples that involve the two charge black holes. And I will explain the quotation marks later when we move to that section. And then we'll move to a section which I call frequently asked questions, because these are questions which I'm frequently asked when I give this talk.
I just ask a frequently asked question.
Yes.
Is this going to be distinct from the explanation of black hole entropy given in terms of the deep brain gas extracting this coming from the black hole?
It's not going to be distinct. Actually, I'm going to, when I discuss it, when I'll be over here, I'm going to connect that to the Sturmage of Alpha story.
So they're not distinct?
No.
Is it connected to the explanation given by the loop in terms of punctures?
I don't see any relation at this point. Any other question before I move to...
Well, why do microstates have to be classical?
They don't have to be classical. No. I didn't say they're classical.
No. So a puzzle doesn't have to be classical?
No, it doesn't have to be classical. So let me give you a definition. So what's the definition? So consider a black hole which has associated gravitational entropy S. So the Fassbender proposal says that associated with this black hole there is an exponential number of horizon-free non-singular solutions which asymptotically look like the black hole but different from it up to the horizon speed.
Solutions of what?
So, sure, I'm going to. So each of the solutions.
We also define horizon free.
Who?
Well, the.
You should state what solution means first. That's a question for later.
Yeah, so let me go slow. Okay. So let me first finish the definition I give over here, then address the. So each of the solutions should represents the black hole microstate, and the original black hole only captures the average behavior of the system. So to really finish this definition, I really have to address the question of solutions of what. So the answer to that is solutions of string theory, and some of these will be realized in supergravity, but the majority of them won't have a supergravity description. So let's say they will have a sigma model description, or if we reach the point where we have well-defined string field theory, that would be regular solutions of string field theory solutions.
You say regular solutions, you mean regular solutions of classical string field theory or just states of string field theory?
Well, some of them would be, let's say, would have, again, a good classical description. This would be completely regular, but there would be no singular. So non-singular means that there's no singular behavior in any sense of the word. And most of this are going to become actually a lot clearer when we view them also from the using ADS-CFT from the other side.
At this level, they're just good, decent states of string field theory we don't have data.
So at this stage, the majority of these states would be some string solutions, where at this point, the only way to understand them is perhaps by using ADS-CFT. Clearly at this point, so what I'm trying to show here, I'm going to first define what the proposal is, then see how much I can do within supergravity, how much I can say, and then eventually move also to understand the stringy aspects.
Just to be picky one more time, if now we're talking about very general string field theory states or something, in that context, do you have an idea of what you mean by the phrase horizon free?
So if there is no, let's say, classical geometry, then of course the notion of horizon is still defined. So the main thrust of that proposal is this says that even at the regime where you think there might be a nice and classical approximation, even in that regime, there's really no horizon. So perhaps another name for that proposal would be the no horizon proposal.
Actually, Skinner's these are meant to be classical at what was the horizon scale, right? Because they're meant to look like black holes.
Now, they're meant to look like black holes asymptotically, so what is well defined is really the asymptotics, the way I'm going to define it as I go on.
At the Schwarzschild radius, is it meant to be classical there?
This,
Because then you could say whether there's a horizon or not at what you thought was the small shot radius, just classically.
So clearly the solution should have a throw that looks like the horizon of the original black hole. But not all of these geometries would be, so the typical geometry, it would be very easy to answer the question, but there would be atypical geometries that really don't look a lot like, let's say, the average behavior. And for those, it's not easy to answer that question. I mean, the point here is that all of these should be well-defined questions, first of all. So that's one of the main issues.
So, if you couldn't interrupt it so much anyway. would you agree that it's a fair rephrasing of what you're saying at this very generic level to say that we think whatever correct theory of quantum gravity we have, in this case let's say string theory, there will be a quantum state for each of those
there will be quantum, you know, state.
As many as exponential of the entropy.
But yes, there will be quantum states, and then some of them they will have, well, let's say, semi classical description, but they won't have horizon. I guess what is drastically different than before is that this no horizon aspect to all levels.
Some of them, but not necessarily most of them.
Some of them, the ones that make sense to discuss of a horizon. Of course, if everything is if the geometry itself is not a well-defined concept in your formulation of your theory, it's very hard to say there's no horizon because the concept doesn't make sense.
The statement is that all the ones that have good classical descriptions,
yes,
you think have ones that are horizon-free.
Yes. Yes.
And I may ask you again later exactly,
yes,
what you mean by that.
Okay. So now let's move to see roughly, let's sketch why this proposal would resolve the black hole puzzles. So first of all, the entropy within this proposal is just standard statistical origin because we have one solution per microstate. And the fact that the entropy scales like the area of the horizon rather than the volume the black hole occupies is the direct consequence of holography. So these solutions have no horizon, therefore there's no information loss. Matter that comes in from infinity will escape back to infinity at late times. And these solutions are also non-singular, so the solution of the singularity is built in this proposal. And furthermore, this resolution of the singularity is dynamically correlated with this non-local fuzz, so it's not like the singularity is resolved in a small, in a Planck, let's say, neighborhood for the singularity. The resolution says that you have to have a non-local fuzz up to the horizon scale. So now let's go back to see the relation of these two ADA CFD, and let's start with the relation of black holes and ADA CFD. So most of the black holes whose entropy we understand quantitatively in string theory have a near horizon region which contains an ADS factor. For example, the Strom-Jabafa-Pritchard system has a near horizon limit region which is ADS 3 cross S3 cross T4 or K3. So the original counting for these black holes used the fact that this is a supersymmetric system, which means it can extrapolate to different regimes. So in particular, you can extrapolate to the regime where one can do a deep brain counting, and then extrapolate back the result to the black hole region. Now, with the advent of ADS-CFT, it was realized that this computation here is part of a larger setup. It's part of ADS-CFT duality. So what one counts when it does this counting is a certain supersymmetric state of the dual CFT. Now, ADS-CFT actually implies more. In particular, implies that for every state of the CFT, there should exist a regular asymptotically ADS solution which captures the depths of gauge invariant operators in that state.
Is your word regular supposed to mean singularity-free, or supposed to also imply horizon-free?
A regular at this point implies singularity-free, then I'm going to address the issue of the horizon a little bit on the same slide.
Okay.
Now. So now let's apply this reasoning to one of the supersymmetric states that one counts or count for the entropy of the, say, the Strom-Jabafa black hole. So we pick one state, so associated with that state, there must exist an asymptotically ADS solution. Now this is a pure state, so it doesn't have any entropy. So this implies that they should be horizon free, because if we have solutions with horizons, then they should have entropy, so they cannot be associated with pure states. But the horizons are associated with thermal states.
But that, I mean, that
right? That's not obvious, because when you have a state, and we're talking about a horizon is basically a classical concept. And in the classical GR gravity limit, you obviously lose a lot of information.
Yeah.
And so
it could... So this specific state is this specific statement is clearly for the cases where there is a corresponding, let's say, semi-classical description of that state, and then it makes sense to use the gravitational description.
But that classical description might apply to more than one state. In passing the semi-classical limit, you can lose the fine-grained resolution you need to pick out.
Oh, absolutely. Actually, we will see this happening later on.
Right.
We will see that there is, for the two-charge case, we will see that there is an exponential number of microstates whose, let's say, description in the two-derivative gravity is just in the solution.
So why would you claim that the horizon in the classical solution means that an individual pure state must in some sense be horizon-free? I mean, to ask the question this way, does it mean anything in this context to talk about a horizon or to either have a horizon or not have a horizon for a pure quantum state?
Well, if there is a good semi-classical description of the state, yeah, it does make sense.
What if
there is a single state, you cannot have a horizon because we know
from... What if there's a good semi-classical description of the state, but it is also the same good semi-classical description you would get of many other quantum states?
But it won't be a good semi-classical description. That's the main point. It won't be a good semi-classical description of many. It would be a singular truncation.
But that has to be shown. I mean, in other words, saying this, if this is true, then obviously you're right. I mean, then black holes can never be formed from pure states. Obviously, there's some fuzzball description, and we should all adopt, you know, fuzzballs and work on that. I mean, so saying it as sort of an obvious statement is I think a little misleading, because this is the heart of the matter, that a pure state cannot have a horizon, because it's not just that horizons are entropies. It's the horizons of property of a classical or semi-classical metric. And you lose information when you try to describe a quantum state.
But I mean, if you go up here, so here you have the state, and this is going to, some of these states would be well described by, let's say, regular supergravity, gravitational asymptotically linear solution. So that specific solution just cannot have horizon, because you just started with a single state. It has no entropy.
I hate to pile onto this point, but when you make statements like this, I really feel like the seminar is in danger of collapsing into nonsense. Let me just give you an example. When RIC collides two gold nuclei begin in their ground state, they're in a pure state, the moments are specified, it's a pure state, and it produces a state all of whose macroscopic properties are described by a black hole, even though we know that secretly it's a thermal state with hidden phase correlations. So that statement is just wrong, and I really am concerned that this whole fuzzball subject builds on a lot of very hazy and incorrect statements. I really wish you hadn't said that.
But I mean, you will see as you go on, okay, this is, first of all, this is a motivating part.
But the motivation is really negative motivation. It's not motivation to believe anything that follows later. I'm sorry to be so hard. This subject has been around for a while, and it seems to rest on a lot of poorly motivated statements that are repeated and are wrong.
But I mean, what you said about the RIC is the average description of the system would be well described by a black hole. There's nothing.
It's a pure state which is described by a black hole geometry with a horizon. It's false. It disagrees. I mean,
I mean, a typical state would behave very close to a thermal state, so it would be very well approximated by horizon.
So what does that statement then mean?
But I'm saying here that horizons are associated with thermal state.
But a pure state can't have a horizon, you're saying. But this is a pure state.
But it would be well approximated by a horizon. I'm saying that
what's the difference between having a horizon and being well approximated by a horizon?
Well, in the actual corrections.
Sorry?
The actual corrections, which would be compatible.
Which kind of corrections?
I mean, you will see as we go on. There will be maps of operators.
Do I have to believe this? Anything on this slide to follow the rest of the talk? I'm really bothered by it. I'm sorry, but you know, since this is a pure state, the corresponding geometry must be horizon free. Again, I don't understand that, but it can be approximated arbitrarily well by having a horizon.
If it is a typical state, it would be not arbitrarily well. It would be approximated very well.
Okay. Now, I guess.
Okay, I can't. If you allow approximate arbitrarily well by a horizon, then I think horizon. I mean, all horizons are only approximate horizons in quantum gravity. So that statement again is a tautology.
Well, the issue is that now even in the regime where you would think that these horizons are, let's say, the two derivative approximation is a good approximation. Even in that regime, there is a more, let's say, finer description.
So you say there are corrections at the level of even the four derivative action.
In some cases, yeah, at the level of the four derivative. I think it would become clear when I move to the actual example and see the more, let's say, substantive. But if one believes in that, then this would indeed just be the plausible proposal. But what this argument doesn't say is it doesn't say that this solution will be well described by supergravity. Actually, most of the states will not be well described by supergravity, will just be some stringy solutions. And part of the part of the program would be to actually understand which fraction of the microstates will have a well good description within supergravity. So the key questions in establishing this proposal would be, okay, first of all, can one find enough such geometries for each black hole? And what properties should such geometries have to be associated with black hole microstates? And suppose you've done this, can you actually quantitatively show how black hole properties emerge upon coarse graining?
By geometries, now you're thinking about some classical geometry.
So in this case, I'm thinking that, of course, the asymptotics will be well-defined in all cases because these are non-normalizable modes. But clearly, in the interior, some of this would be... to really do this entire program completely would require to have control at a string level.
Okay. Another question. So consider a lump of coal in a pure state and a lump of coal in a thermal ensemble. To know which you have, you can't do it with a single experiment. You would have to do E to the S experiments of all types, and then you would know which you had.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're going to say it tells us that for a black hole, you wouldn't have to do E to the S experiments. You can determine it in one experiment if you were which pure state you were in.
I think we'll have to wait a very long time and to be able to measure all the values of each environment.
All of them. So, okay, so it's going to be, it will be a subtle, okay, good.
Yeah.
Okay. So when you say it's not enough, you say when you say it doesn't have a horizon, the sense in which it doesn't, the difference from a state that has a horizon is extremely, extremely subtle.
Absolutely.
Yes. Even not one measurement, but in fact, repeated measurements.
Yeah, so repeated measurements for very long time.
Repeated of the same, not, yeah, okay.
Good. Yes. And clearly, unless one explicitly demonstrates that one can get black hole properties emerging out of coarse graining this possible geometries, I don't think this would be convincing. You have to see that the average description coming out. So in understanding this issue, the first step is to understand the simplest possible non-trivial cases. The simplest possible case is the supersymmetric two-charge system, like the D1-D5 system, or the three-charge system, such as the D1-D5P system. Okay. So I have argued that ADS-CFT implies the form of the possible proposal must hold, and I think here perhaps the emphasis is on the form of the possible proposal, because clearly I'm not suggesting that this is, let's say, a supergravity description. So to quantitatively address the relevant questions, we will need precision holography. So we'll simply deduce the fact that there is a dual description. So I will start this talk by summarizing the status of holographic methods and then return to the applications to the possible program. Now, these methods that I'm going to describe in this part of the talk should underline the applications of holography to any other system, such as, say, DHPCP, holographic modeling, DHPCP quark gluon plasma, applications to condensed matter systems, etc. So I hope even if you don't believe in the whole part of the program, that part would be useful. So what is the main question? So suppose I give you a geometry which is conjectured to have a holographic dual. So what exactly would one like to extract? So So to be definite, let me pose the question in the context of asymptotically ADS cross-section geometries, where this is a compact space, in which we have already identified a CFT which is dual to ADS cross-X. For instance, let's say ADS 5 crosses 5. And so we're given a solution which is asymptotically ADS 5 crosses 5, and we already know that ADS 5 crosses 5 is dual to n equals 4 Springer angle. So I would like to know.
I'm sorry to harp on this, but I guess you caught me in a bad mood or something. or more, maybe more, because I take ADS CFT very seriously and don't want to see it misquoted. So ADS CFT tells us that a black hole is dual to a ball of hot gas. That's its essential content. And I didn't see you using any of the properties of a ball of hot gas to motivate the fuzz ball. That is, I mean, you seem to be saying you were using ADS CFT, but actually you were stating prejudices that came from somewhere else. I don't feel that the fact that a black hole is actually a ball of hot gas motivated any of the statements that you made.
So maybe after when I review the application of ADS CFT.
Is this a frequently asked question?
This is not so frequently asked. Maybe I'll add it to my list.
Please continue.
But I mean, you will see explicitly how I apply ADS CFT when we move to the possible program, and then you can ask again whether. So this setup over here is very general, but still not completely general enough for all applications one would like to have. For instance, the cases like the Sakai Shimoda model or the Klebanov Strasser solutions or setups of holographic UCD. So everything that I'm going to discuss here, we are also currently working on developing the corresponding dictionary for these cases. So such as geometries, namely ones which are asymptotically ADS cross-X, should describe states in the conformal field theory or states in the formations of the conformal field theory. So the first thing that we would like to deduce from this geometry, we would like to deduce the vacuum structure which corresponds to that geometry, namely the vacuum expectation values and parameters of the formation. So to illustrate this, let me consider the case of the D1, D5 system, since this is relevant to the black hole example. So in that case, the decoupling region is asymptotically ADS 3 crosses 3 cross X4. Now recall that the supergravity spectrum of fluctuations around that solution corresponds to the Kaya primaries of the D1, D5 CFT. And the lowest dimension operators include the stress energy tension, the asymmetry current, along with Kaluza-Klein excitations. And in this way, we obtain towers of Kaya primary operators with increasing dimension.
I'm going to intervene here now. My turn. this is only true for supersymmetric setups. I know that you're saying that the D1, D5 system, but there's also non-supersymmetric black hole that one can.
Sure. So this.
So I just have a feeling that if you just stick to chiral primaries, you're always going to fall short in the end, because there's many things that are not supergravity.
Oh, absolutely. So that's another. One can tell ahead of time that roughly the degeneracy that you might possibly see within supergravity is the same growth as the two-charge solution. So you definitely are not going to see the entire degeneracy with supergravity, precisely for the reason you just said. Within supergravity, what we really have good handle is the verbs of the chiral primaries, not all the other operators. The other operators correspond to say string states, etc. And one would have to have better handle of those as well.
And the stuff that's supergravity, which is not chiral primaries, you pick some random harmonic on the X4 that can still be described by supergravity, but it's not chiral primary. It's not massless in ADS 3 process 3, but it is massless in 10 dimensions.
So the stuff that we can, let's say, reliably extract using the methods I'm discussing here are the vacuum expectation values of chiral primaries. So that's what I'm saying here. So I'm going to extract the verbs of these operators. Of course, there are other operators which, within the setup, I don't have access. And I would have liked to have access. But I think this is a general limitation. I don't think anybody could extract the verbs of all these other operators. So. But I mean, let's go on to see exactly what So what we would like to do is we would like to extract the values of these operators, because this would characterize at least partly the field theory state that, the field theory state to which the geometry corresponds to. So let me start by first reviewing the what they call the naive dictionary. So for given geometry, one can often see the existence of a verb qualitatively using a sort of linearized ABACFT dictionary, which was developed around 1998-1999, where the normalizable modes in the near boundary asymptotics just correspond to the verbs. So just to remind you this, so for example, let's write the ADS metric in this coordinates, and suppose we have a scalar field that has mass of that type, then the asymptotic Kramer distribution is given by expression of that form. And then this is a non-normalizable mode, and this is a normalizable mode. And then this linearized dictionary identifies this mode with the source and this mode with the verb. So extracting the verbs quantitatively from an asymptotic ADS cosec geometry is actually rather more subtle than this simplification. And the main reason is that once one moves to the full nonlinear bulk system, the relationship, which I just reviewed, it just becomes nonlinear. Now, while in some cases this linearized approximation gives an answer which is qualitatively correct, there are equally many known cases where the answer is qualitatively incorrect. For example, one gets a case where the energy is non-zero, even though this is meant to be a space metric solution, or one could find that it seems as if there are verbs for operators which are kinematically prohibited from acquiring verbs. For example, one can have the top component of a supermatriclet that seems like it has a verb, even though the solution is symmetric. So just using the name dictionary, except in the very, very few cases, in almost all cases, we're just going to give a wrong answer. So holographic formulas for the verbs and other endpoint functions can be derived in all generality for arbitrary backgrounds which are asymptotically ADS cross X. This full program only finished a couple of years ago. And this derivation follows from the basic principles of gravity gauge theory duality, which relate bulk fields to boundary gauge invariant operators and the bulk partition function to the generating function of boundary correlators. And this exact formulas, which I'm going to review in a minute, relate the verbs of all gauge invariant primary operators non-linearly in terms of the coefficients in the asymptotic expansion of the bulk supergravity fields. So I'm not going to describe the derivation, I'm just going to give you a few details. So to understand how to derive these formulas, one needs to understand how to deal with infinite volume divergences, and one also has to understand how to properly take into account the compact part of the geometry. Or in other words, how to access the depths of all primaries, not just those captured by gauge supergravity. Now the first of these issues, the issue of the infinite volume divergences, is dealt by the formalism of holographic normalization, which is the precise gravitational analog of quantum field theory normalization. While the second issue of how to deal with the compact part of the geometry is addressed by this formalism of college applied holography, which is basically derives a nonlinear college applied map from, let's say, 10 to 5 dimensions. Now, to explain these formulas, I need to tell you a little bit about asymptotically locally ADS spacetimes. So these spacetimes solve Einstein's equations with negative cosmological constant and have the following asymptotic form. So this looks very similar to what I showed you earlier for ADS. The only difference is in the form of our metric. So this takes that form. So this is an arbitrary boundary metric, and the glue coefficients are locally determined in terms of G0, where this coefficient over here is undetermined by asymptotics. This is determined by dynamics in the interior. Now that expansion is non-covariant because it's an expansion in coordinate, but there is a way to organize this expansion covariantly in terms of Hankel functions of scale transformations. This is actually something that is important if one wants to actually move to describe the full system. because the underlying structure of normalized holographic correlators is best exhibited in a so-called radial Hamiltonian formalism, where the radial coordinate plays a role of time. A fundamental property of asymptotically locally ABS spacetimes is that the scale transformations are part of the asymptotic symmetries. So this means that every covariant quantity can be decomposed into a sum of terms, each having a definite scaling. Actually, one can use this as an alternative definition of asymptotically locally ABS spacetimes. So in particular, the radial canonical momentum pi can be decomposed into eigenfunctions of scale transformations pi sub k of weight k. And furthermore, each of these eigenfunctions is related to the asymptotic coefficients by, in general, a nonlinear relation. And I will briefly show you in a few slides how they look like. So now, using these building blocks, it's easy to see how the exact formula looks like. So the exact formula has a piece which is linear in momentum, has a number of pieces which are nonlinear in momentum. So these other pieces are really the conjugate momenta corresponding to all the black fields. So actually, you will see this more in an example in the next slide. So these terms which are nonlinear in the momenta are related to the so-called extrema correlators. So these terms appear only when, let's say, the sum of the dimensions is equal to the dimension of that operator. So let's see this a little bit more explicitly in an example. So suppose that the boundary theory contains a dimension 4 operator and two dimension 2 operators, and the corresponding bound field is 5 sine pi. So the formula will have the following form. So there will be a linear term, and there will be quadratic terms in the momenta. So here, okay, 2 plus 2 is 4, so that's why it's extremal couplings. And this black coefficient is just some numerical coefficient. Now, this piece over here is related to the asymptotic, so pi. So the generic form is what I give over here. So this piece here is the normalizable node. But in general, there's also, in many cases, complicated local combination of the sources and the not again the normalizable modes of the other fields. So the naive dictionary would ignore all of these terms, would also ignore this function, and just consider this. So that's the difference. Now, if you were straightforwardly derive that expression, and as you know was done 7-8 years ago, this looks a rather complicated expression, and you don't understand why you have this local function together with that one. But this eventually was understood because it's really that combination, which is the eigenfunction and the dilatation operator. That's why this is a preferred system, because it tells you nicely how to organize the various terms. And similarly, if you would try to extract the depth of a dimension 4 operator, this tells you that it's not sufficient to just look at the corresponding bound field. You really have to look also at all the fields that have that correspond to operators of lower dimension, because this would actually contribute in this formula. Okay, so now on with this. Let me now give you the. We're now ready to state the holographic map. So we started saying that we have a solution which is asymptotically ABS cross X. So this means that we can write the metric as a perturbation around ABS P cross X Q. Well, these are the perturbations. So these perturbations admit an asymptotic expansion as R goes to zero, which is a conformal boundary, with a further expansion in terms of the harmonics of the compact space X Q, like S5, for instance. So schematically, there is an expansion of that form. Here, this is the radial derivative, and this is denotes all the harmonics, scalar harmonics, derivatives, etc., all the harmonics. So then what we instructed to do is we instructed to extract this coefficient over here. And then that coefficient here, we plug in this holographic formula, which in general is, again, nonlinear. So this gives a direct map between the asymptotics of the supergravity solution to one-point functions of dual operators. Okay, that's the main result of this part of the talk.
And just, this allows you to treat arbitrary harmonics on the sphere? Or
yeah, arbitrary harmonics.
So this is really the full 10 or 11 dimensional supergravity.
Yes.
It's not just the some truncation.
Yeah, it's not the truncation. But the point is that depending on the dimension of this operator, this expansion here, so here I put dot, dot, dot. But for instance, if you are for dimension 4 operator, you already saw it in the previous slide. It's only pi 2s that contribute the time formula. So this means you only have to consider the contribution for the corresponding, let's say, phi, psi, and chi, not the other fields. If you're in dimension 6, you have to consider more fields, et cetera.
So is this just in the bulk? Is just the fact that there's a coupling between these different fields? I mean, if you diagonalize the bulk fields, would it be linear again?
No, it would never be really linear, except, and also depends on which what level you're discussing. So these couplings here, these terms, these extremal couplings, really come from boundary terms in 10 dimensions. And these nonlinear terms over here comes from interactions in the actual, let's say, lower dimensional field equations. I mean, if the theory is interacting, then you will have this type of terms. So let me give you a few remarks. First of all, this method allows to extract quantum field theory data from any supergravity solution, which is asymptotically ds cross x. And this is done only using algebraic manipulations. And I have to look at the asymptotic, do the harmonic analysis, and extract various coefficients. So this data can be used to identify or verify what's the holographic dual. So these formulas are derived in full generality. So they're associated with an action, not with a specific field equation. So you do this computation once and for all, and then you can use them for all solutions of the same action. And furthermore, these methods can be used to do strong quantitative tests of gravity gauge theory duality beyond the conformal point. So here are two tests that we've done. One test is just to look at any cosmos being in the Coulomb branch. So one can use this method to extract the verbs of all Cayley primary operators from the near horizon limit of the general multi-center diffeomorphic solutions. So in this case, because the solution has 16 supercharges, you expect this to be unnormalized. So then we computed the same verbs on the field theory, and there is a precise agreement between the two. In a sense, this is an infinite set of numbers that agree between the two theories. And a similar analysis for the LLM bubbling solutions provides a very precise map between the geometries and half PPA states of any cosmos and Wilson R cross S3, and an equally impressive agreement between gravitational and quantum field theory computations of apps. Actually, this analysis here is, in a sense, is part of that, because we can take the limit of the LLM solutions that produce the bubbling solutions. So this is, the most impressive agreement is the agreement done at this level, because this then follows from the agreement for the n plus 4 follows from the limit of that one.
No, that's not true. The LLM is just mechanically the Coulomb branch in some particular two-dimensional plane, whereas the one in N equal 4 Yang is on the full Coulomb branch.
Yeah, yeah. But you can always, once you choose a verb, then you can rotate to evolve only to...
That's only true if you have one verb, but here you have N D-brains, you have verbs scattered in all directions, and eventually you get not just one verb, but a lot of them.
But then you can do a further thing. If it is an SO2 symmetric, you can always...
No, but it's not SO2 symmetric in general. The general point of the N equal 4 Coulomb branch does not have any symmetry.
So then in the generic point, indeed, you won't be able to connect. But the ones that do have the symmetry, this involve more and more terms. This prop more to this nonlinear relation than the other one. So any questions about the holographic methods before I...
Yeah, just to make sure I understand the origin of these nonlinear terms.
Yes.
Is it just that if I take the 10-dimensional supergravity and I Kaluza-Klein reduce on the compact part, in the effective action I have terms which are linear in a given field and multiply a number of other fields, and so when I compute the first derivative of the effective action with respect to the source, I get a verb that depends on this.
So if you start from 10 dimensions, there are many sources of non-linearities. So so first of all, you have to make sure that your computation doesn't depend on the coordinates you're using, because you can do different morphisms that mix the harmonics among themselves. So the way we deal with this is that we define VH invariant combinations, which are nonlinear combinations of this harmonic. So this is one source of the nonlinearities. The second source of the nonlinearities is in the actual Kaluza-Klein map, which has to be nonlinear. So just linear reduction doesn't suffice, clearly. So this gives you another set of nonlinearity. And then you get, let's say, the five-dimensional fields. And then there are now non-linearities that come from doing the asymptotic analysis. So there are, let's say, three different sources of non-linearities, plus the ones that come from boundary terms in 10 dimensions. So four different sources of non-linearities. So it's very hard to disentangle. I mean, in the explicit computation, you can see where they're coming from, but it's hard to say, it's hard to switch them off. It's almost impossible to switch them off. And in almost all cases, you will have to take this. Any other questions?
I just to clarify, but at a linearized level, I would just have a bunch of couple linear equations. If I diagonalize those, I mean, it might be hard, but if I diagonalize those, then the eigenmodes wouldn't have nonlinear terms.
So do you start from...
In the effective 5D action.
For five dimensions, from the lower dimensional action?
Yes, I have a lot of fields, and I just want the linearized equations, and they're all coupled, but I could diagonalize them in principle.
So then
I think there wouldn't be any nonlinear.
So this depends on whether your theory describes a deformation or not. If you have a deformation, then the terms which are nonlinear, this my function f of phi naught would contribute.
But they're all normalizable, right?
So if it is a state, and then if you well, that depends again on the dimension of the operator, because if you go back here, I mean, this function here could depend on, so if you're in a high enough dimension, would still be hit by these terms. This term just come from solving the asymptotics. Okay, so this is the techniques I'm going to use in order to scrutinize the Fassbull proposal. So now I'm going to return to Fassbull. So the simplest system to analyze is the 2 charge D1-D5 system. And in this case, the naive geometry is actually not a black hole. So what one might call is more black hole, because the spherical solution has a naked singularity. So this is expected to be resolved by alpha prime corrections. But of course, the fact that this has a naked singularity makes this system not very nice to illustrate. Now, for that system, the degeneracy of the D-brain, or the corresponding D-brain system, is exactly analogous to that of the 3-charge system. And for light charges, leads to degeneracy, which is of that form, where N1 and N5 are the number of D1 and D5 brains. And this setup, the Fassbull picture suggests that there should be an explanation number of regular and horizon supergravity solutions, which asymptotically look like the naive solution, but differ from it in the interior. So let's see whether in that specific case we can find those. Now, to find those, recall that the D1, D5 system can be related by dualities to fundamental strings carrying momentum. And in this case, supergravity solutions, which are describing strings with arbitrary weights, have been known for some time, almost 15 years. So these are chiral null models that have a metric of that form, and they have also a Dilithium 2 form. And H, K, and AM are harmonic functions which are sourced on an arbitrary curve, FM. So this curve just describes the profile of this thing. Now, to obtain general D1, D5 Fassbull solutions, we started from the solutions, and we dualize to the D1, D5 system. So there are two cases. One is D1, D5 solutions of type 2B on D4. And these are obtained by dualizing F2 solutions of type 2B on D4 and use standard S&T dualities. And the second case is D1, D5 solutions of type 2B on K3. And these are obtained by starting from F2 solutions of the erotic on D4 then we first map this to NS5 with momentum of type 2A and K3, and then you use the appropriate density dualities. So these solutions are characterized by a curve in an n-dimensional space. So this is a 24-dimensional space for K3, and it's the more general such solution. And it's an 8-dimensional curve in the case of T4, and this is a more general solution which carries only bosonic excitations. And there are also other solutions, so one should still describe solutions with fermionic condensates. So the curve that appears over here is the profile of the string in the original FP system, as well as the profile of the charge wave in the case of the heterotic FP system. So these solutions have the following features. I will shortly flash the solution, but I think I'll first describe a little bit how they look. So first of all fields of type 2B are non-trivial in the solutions. And these solutions are determined in terms of a number of harmonic functions, which are determined in terms of these curves. So roughly they look like this, where this is the curve that sources the actual solution. Now, some of the solutions were known for quite some time. These are the solutions found by Runyon and Matur in 2001. And these are the subsets where the curve lies in a four-dimensional space rather than this 24 or eight-dimensional space. So the remaining part, namely the ones which are described on this other curve, the four-dimensional part, this describes excitations inside T4 or K3. So that's how the solution looks like. So the only purpose of this slide is to show you that it can fit in one slide. And you can already recognize, I mean, the first part clearly looks like, let's say, the naive D1D5 system. So now let me start discussing what is the correspondence of these solutions to black hole microstates. So first of all of the solutions have the same mass and conserved charges at flat infinity as the naive singular D1D5 system. Secondly, these solutions are non-singular and horizon-free as long as the defining curve on R4 does not self-intersect and has only isolated zeros. And thirdly, these solutions have also non-zero angular momentum if these curves are non-zero, and moreover have multiple moments. That we expect because all fields would have none, but there were no corresponding charges. Now, prior to our work, the only evidence that these solutions could be related to two-charged microstates was that they had the correct charges and horizons. But all of the solutions have decoupling regions, where the solution becomes asymptotically AGS3 cross S3 cross T4 or T3. So one may use the holographic methods I just described to probe the field field rule. In principle, this gives an infinite amount of other data, namely the depths of higher primary operators, which are encoded in the geometry, and this is the precise way where the field theory knows about multiple moments. Okay, so these solutions are characterized by harmonic functions. So near the AGS boundary, this can be expanded in a standard fashion. So the important thing here is the red piece, which is the piece that we meant to extract, and this red piece you can see is determined in terms of the curve. It's just some integral of the defining curve. So what we did is we used the method of Kaluza-Klein holography in order to extract the depth of higher primary operators using these asymptotics. So this was a long, complicated with lots of technicalities. So I'm going to sketch for you the results. So first of all, the stress energy tension for all of the solutions is not equal to zero. And that's in agreement with the fact that the fuzzballs are projectionally dual to Ramon ground states. Furthermore, there are non-zero depths for the asymmetric pattern and also scalar primaries. So schematically, one has expressions of that form where this S here, the S are just given you the form, which is dependent on the curve. So as I have been emphasizing in this talk, there are four more data which are encoded in the geometry, not just the charges. So any proposal for the holographic dual of the geometries must be consistent with the depths. So let's discuss briefly the field theory dual. So the dual CFT is a deformation of the sigma model with target space, the symmetric orbit of the quantification manifold. So these holographic results that I just reviewed invalidated earlier proposals that associated each possible solution to an R-charge eigenstate. So I guess this is a point to also emphasize that the, I mean, this is not philosophy, it can be falsified. Like the earlier proposal was invalidated by a very specific computation.
But there's also something very special. Here you're getting actual supergravity solutions.
Yes.
So there's no question what the metric is, but then you're representing the
yes.
state by a metric.
Yes.
I think then there's no question. We all know whether there's a horizon or not a horizon.
Yes. Right, right.
In
right.
that case. So do you know what's special about this case? I mean, you don't expect this to be true for all black holes.
So
classical solution.
Ask this again because I will address the supergravity, because there is an issue with supergravity approximation already here.
Okay.
But ask again if I'm not if I don't fully address this. So as I said, this result just invalidated earlier proposals. So at least at the beginning, it seemed almost completely impossible to reconcile the Fadbur proposal with the actual results. But at the end, we did find a precise map which associates any given supergravity solution to a specific superposition of Ramon-Brown states. And the exact form of the superposition depends non-trivially on the curves that determine the solution. So next I'm going to describe for you this proposal. The motivation for the proposal comes to the duality from where the solutions came from. So here the proposal involves three steps. So as I said, the actual solution is determined by a curve. So the first step is to extract the Fourier coefficients. So we extract the Fourier coefficients from the curve that we consider an associated coherent state. At this point, this has nothing to do with a dual CFT. I'm just giving you an algorithm. So containing that state, this coherent state, there are four states of that form that they satisfy the restriction that the sum of the products of these numbers is just given by N1 and phi. So we're given a curve, we extract this coherent state, then we look for states that have this property. So we retain only these terms in the coherent state. And then we map the FT oscillators to the conformal field theory Ramon Brown states via the dictionary I give over here. So it has been known since the work of Waff and Witten on N equals 4, topological N equals 4 theory, that there is a map between Ramon Brown states and FT oscillators, which is given over here. So there are more ground states. There is an operator which is associated with the P2 homology of the entire manifold, and the N here is increased. So then, again, we start from here. We have the Fourier coefficients. We look for states that satisfy that relation, and then we apply this map. So this gives a definition. So the solution should be dual to that state. So that's a proposal. So then what we did is we compute the verbs of gauge invariant operators in that state, and we found exact agreement with the gravity computation that I did earlier. Of course, within the approximations used, and I will discuss this in a minute. So in a sense, this had to be the case because there are normalization theorems precisely for this lab. But in my view, this is a very strong test of the proposal. The two computations are completely different. You could have filled this very many places. So. But let's address now the issue that you have been asking me throughout this talk. What's the relation between fuzzballs and classical geometries? So in general, one can see already from that system, one has to go beyond supergravity to accurately describe the physics of this system. And there are many reasons for this. First of all, most of the geometries I already described, they contain small regions of high curvatures, so they are really not well described as supergravity. You really have to start including high derivative corrections. But things are even worse if one includes the geometries with internal excitations, because if we look at the geometries with all internal excitations and no external excitations, then the solution that I gave you earlier just collapses to the naive geometries. So these are not just a few, let's say, microstates. This should really account for a finite fraction of the black hole entropy, but all of those are just not visible in supergravity approximation. And it's also clear from the setup that it's not like there are some other solutions that one can find, because we really have the more general set within supergravity. And we know we have the more general setup, because we know that we started from the from the more general FP system. So it's clear, it's clearly the case that it would never be the case that Fassbold suggests classical geometries. But even in the cases where the geometries only involve macroscopic spheres, for instance, you can have a solution that just comes from, let's say, a big ellipse. So even in that cases, different solutions, so let's say we have a big ellipse and we have a circle that have relatively similar scales. So even in that case, if you want to resolve the difference between the solutions, one has to go to look beyond supergravity, because the vars that one extracts differ from each other by very small amounts. So this is really one of our effects.
So given all of these things, how did you manage to get a precise matching between the VAMS computed via supergravity methods and the VAMS computed in the CFC?
So it is within that approximation. Of course, things which we don't have under control, they didn't have to agree, and we didn't actually compare.
So it's a philosophical question. As you say, most of the geometries contain high curvature regions that are not under control at all. So why would I expect that you would succeed to any approximation in matching the VAMS?
In some cases, you can see that, let's say, within your, but I mean, you know what are your approximations. You know when you can trust your solution. Or, for instance, there are cases where you know that certain one-point functions should be zero, either because of symmetries or because of specific selection rules of, let's say, three-point functions in an orbital CFD. And then you can go back and see, are these lefts zero?
Hold on. That's not an orbital CFD.
Yeah, sure, but there are non-normalization theorems for this specific correlators.
What's the nature of the non-normalization theorems in that case? Because I'm really curious, because usually the non-normalization theorem tells you something about the dimension of an operator being non-renormalized, not the BEV. BEV is only, let's say, non-renormalized in a Wilsonian prescription, but when you actually try to do any reasonable physical measurement, it depends a lot on what you do.
Well, I mean, in this case, let's say the depth of an operator in non-trivial state is mapped to a three-point function to perform a point. So then you're looking for non-normalization theorems about three-point functions, similar to the one, let's say, for the case of n equals 4 Shapiro-Yang-Mills. So.
Yeah, but again, those theorems have a lot of assumptions built into the proof.
Well, sure. Then you can take this as an additional evidence that they hold, because one does a computation on the gravity and then does a filtering computation and you get the same answer.
Let me give you a little bit of an example. If you actually do families of conformal field theories, which is what you're describing here, we know that the Hilbert space of the field theory is a non-trivial variation of the family. And you can see curvature, and this is computed in some four-point functions and higher. In the conformal field theory. So what that means is that there's no unique non-normalization theorem that can make everything flat, which is roughly what I think you're saying. So this is why I'm really...
But I mean, you can take this, if you want to view it as, let's say, a puzzle why they agree, sure, I mean, you can try to do, let's say, prove why the specific ones that they agree, but this is... The non-normalization theorem is not an input of a computation. You just do two different computations, and we got the same answer.
But could I ask, I mean, you checked this for just the geometries which didn't have regions of large curvature?
Yeah, we checked it for, let's say, big ellipse, where they don't have, you know, that it doesn't have...
Okay, but if you were to take, say, the generic member of this place, you would not expect them to agree?
Yeah, if you would take the ones that have high curvature size.
Okay.
You would expect the corrections to come in. Actually, we also did the opposite. We tried to do holographic engineering. You can say, you know, suppose you start from that state. Now let's compute the one-point functions that state, and then let's try to build the geometry, at least asymptotically, to see how it looks like. And you can do that. You can push this to a certain degree, and then you can see that the VEVs, they differ so little from each other, like a big ellipse from... they just differ by effects of order one over n, so it's clear that this heat cannot really pass. But I mean, you can explicitly see all of these things. So it's a lot more subtle than, let's say, naive association of geometry with.
For your supergravity solution with finite curvature, are you actually able to see the 1 over n effects, or are you saying that it is only in principle? this only in principle distinguishes the
VEFs? I mean, you can see that the actual VEFs, that the VEFs of two nearby solutions is just different by a very, very small amount, which is 1 over n.
And so were you able to compute this?
We didn't compute the corrections, the 1 over n.
One last technical question. Your statement that geometry is the only internal excitations collapsed in Nyusian geometry, that's a statement about the 10-dimensional geometry collapses, the Nyusian
10-dimensional one becomes the naive ADS3 crosses 3 cross 2D4. Yes.
But are you allowing the curve to wander around non-trivially in the internal direction?
Yeah, sure. It's a more general term, yes. I can just put the FIs to zero and have the other either 4 or let's say 20-dimensional curve be whatever it wants.
And then the solution you get doesn't depend on what the curve is doing in the internal direction?
No, it just collapses to the naive. Actually, you can understand why. You can also understand why. Because you can see what kind of operators you have at your disposal at the supergravity level. So you can see you don't have the right operators that would actually acquire a VEF. So you really have to be operators correspond to a string modes that possibly acquire that would distinguish between
there's string modes and there's the supergravity modes that come from the extra K3. When you're doing all these S-dualities and T-dualities and stuff like that, you're starting from some essential supergravity solution, producing another supergravity solution, and you're not really exciting anything that would really call a string.
Well, in this case, I'm saying that the actual supergravity solutions, of course, do not excite the string, but I'm saying if you want to describe the microstates, which only have internal excitations and do not have an excitation in the transverse space, that you have to go beyond what we did. What we did doesn't capture that. Okay, so now let me go back to briefly discuss an issue of, say, typical fuzzballs and the emergence of horizons. One can ask how much a typical fuzzball geometry would differ from the naive black hole solution. So now that we have set up this ADS-CFT dictionary, it's easy to answer this. If we just go into UV, namely close to the conformal boundary, all solutions should look like the naive solution, since in the UV we only see the conformal behavior. But then the solutions should start differing at energies which are comparable to the scale set by the VEF of the most relevant DH invariant operator. Now, using ADS-CFT, we can translate that energy scale to a radial distance r. And then we can go and compute the area of the constant r surface, where r is obtained by estimating the VEF of the lowest dimension operator in a typical state of the D1D5 system. And if you would do this computation, one finds that this area behaves like square root n1 and 5, which is precisely what one would expect from the degeneracy of the D1-5 system. At least in that case, it seems like that one finds that this constant R surface acts like a stretch horizon. So let me summarize that part. So I hope after going through that example, it becomes clear what I mean when I say what the ADS-CFT implies that some form of the possible proposal must fall.
I missed the logic, but we'll get to that now.
Yes.
Now we have to come back to that.
So in my view, the success in constructing a map from this horizon-free solutions to microstates and the two-jet system consistently with the ADS-CFT correspondence provides the most stringent test of the possible proposal today. However, generically, one needs to go beyond the leading supergravity approximation to extract the physics, and it's likely that there does not exist enough geometries well-described and distinguishable in supergravity to span the entire set of black hole microstates. However, if one wants to be optimistic, one could hope that one can find a sufficiently representative basis. So to understand this, we have to understand quantitatively how typical is the state which is associated with any possible solution, and this would require to understand more precisely the map between geometries and states. For instance, today there are known free charge possible solutions, but it's not known exactly to what they correspond and how difficult they are. Okay, so now let me move to my frequently asked question. So one question is that people ask, why is it that people didn't think about this before? So here's one answer to that. So this picture has certain similarities with the point of view which is pursued by the Russian school in the beginning in the 60s, where they argue that singularities are artifacts of spherical symmetry, and a generic non-symmetric solution would be non-singular, because we call it the solutions that, that all these possible solutions are not spherically symmetric, even though the original solution was spherically symmetric. So this idea was disfavored quite quickly, a few years later, in part because the Russian school actually found families of non-symmetric solutions which contain singularities. And to some extent, the work is remembered for that, for this PPL behavior. And principally because of the Penrose working singularity theorems. So another question then is the possible proposal consistent with the singularity theorems? Because this says, okay, there shouldn't be any singularities. Now, singularity theorems rest on three main conditions, an energy condition, a condition of global structure, and requiring that the gravity is strong enough somewhere to trap a region. So for the Fuzzball, it's really this last condition that is not satisfied, because Fuzzball just doesn't contain trapped surfaces.
Sorry to interrupt you, but I think there's another element, which is that in four dimensions there are no gravitational solitons. So you wouldn't expect to find solutions that are completely regular and free with asymptotic charges.
Well, I think this is probably related to my next frequently asked question, which is the question, but is it the case that generic initial conditions would lead to horizon formation? How is this possible proposal meant to apply to astrophysical or gravitational collapse? Now, in this context, the possible proposal would be that there exist possible solutions which describe the collapse of initial data avoiding horizon singularity formation, and the late-time quasi-stationary solution would differ from the corresponding black hole only at the sub-horizon scale. And that matches to what he said. So the actual possible solutions would necessarily involve many more fields than just the metric, because the generic state in the dual QFT has non-zero depths, many operators, not just the stress and the tension. So a generic possible solution, many fields would be turned on. Like, okay, in the two-charge case, we started with a solution that only involved the metric and the three-quarter and the dilaton, but the possible solutions really involved all fields of type 2B. So the singular behavior that we see when we just look at the vacuum Einstein equations, in this case is likely to be a manifestation of the truncation of the very small subset of the full phase space. So like, as we said, that if you just look at the metric, you just don't have enough phase space, you just forget too much, that's why you find the singular behavior. Okay, so...
Sorry, Christos.
Yes.
Isn't it true that under very general assumptions for the form of the matter that couples to gravity, you can show that in gravitational collapse you do form horizons?
Well, but in most cases, let's say the actual analysis involves very few fields, where this seems to imply that the one would need really to have really a lot more fields.
Well, but at the end of the day, it's just a bunch of scalars and fermions.
It's not just a bunch.
And gauge fields.
I mean, even so from here, one can see, so the classical phase space of that theory is really the force, the source and the ref part of the corresponding supergravity field. That's what you see at the supergravity level. And that grows like exponential square root n1 and pi. But for the actual situation, just supergravity field won't be sufficient.
So let's break this down a little bit. It sounds like you're saying if you've studied the real theory, whatever it is, that no trapped surface would ever form, although you have this out someplace that, well, maybe that's only true if you include certain stringier quantum corrections and so forth. So let me first ask, you said before that a fuzzball or a collection of fuzzballs might approximate a black hole very, very well in certain contexts. Would you also say that a fuzzball solutions of this kind might approximate the formation of a trapped surface extremely well?
Well, I mean, in the generic case, would be very close. If you average over, let's say, the verbs of the other operators, then, well, it would average to zero. So you want approximately see them.
So this model, this statement, does not necessarily mean that in an astrophysical context where I, as a classical GR person, expect a trap surface to form, this does not necessarily mean that you would expect marked deviations from my predictions of my computer simulations or anything else.
You will really have to wait very long because the actual, let's say, the size of the VEFs would be very small to be seen by, let's say...
And very long might mean comparable to a Hawking evaporation timescale or something like that?
I mean, one could possibly estimate this, but okay, clearly this hasn't been done. Yes.
Sorry to harp on this, but since we've gotten down to sort of the real sort of question in my mind about this proposal there, I mean, I think the D1, D5 is system is very special. And I think it's amazing that there's all these non-singular states and it matches up so well. But I really am not convinced that that's evidence that is true for all black holes. And so, for example, I mean, we know that the density of the matter at the point that it forms a traditional black hole goes like 1/(mass).
Mm-hmm.
So if you take all the mass of the galaxy and cause it to collapse, it forms a black hole and the density is about that of air. Okay, so it's hard to imagine any stringy effects or higher modes or anything to come in there. And it's hard for me to imagine that a trapped surface at least doesn't form. I mean, whether you actually get event horizons is a global property, and that can depend on what happens at the singularity and everything. But you're somehow saying that it's not. You're saying
I think if you view things from, let's say, the bulk point of view, it's very hard to actually understand what precisely fails. But if you start viewing it from the other side, from the CFT side, it's clear that it's not just the stress engine tension that acquires it. Because if you just... it's really all the other operators that become important.
I can imagine they all get excited later on. Near the singularity, I'm very sympathetic to the idea that you get excited every, you know, all the possible string modes. It may even be non-singular in some sense. But it's this idea that this thing is extended all the way out to the horizon, which I find very hard to...
Well, sure, and this would have to be clearly demonstrated. And this hasn't been demonstrated at any level, because the two-charge case doesn't have a macroscopic horizon. So the only thing which has been one can demonstrate is what I said earlier, that by just estimating the VEF of a typical state, one gets the correct scaling with charges. One can take this as evidence, the fact that the actual dual filter, even though naively everything could happen, the Planck scale has the right scaling. But this is such a special system. I mean, clearly this has to be demonstrated. I mean, both either in supersymmetric system or even better in non-supersymmetric systems.
Let me reword Gary's question as follows. You accepted my suggestion that your proposal means that trap surfaces don't form in some sense.
Yes.
But then you said that you're happy to have your fuzzballs approximate trap surfaces in some sense very well for very long times. Now, a trap surface is not typically a local notion, but it is defined on a given slice or a given instant of time. So, you know, if I have a...
So I'm saying for the asymptotic observer, I think the better way to say if you're an asymptotic observer,
yes,
it's going to be very difficult to distinguish. You have to wait very long to actually distinguish between the difference between the actual fuzzball and the... and whether, let's say, you form a trapped surface.
Is your statement that there's a sense in which trapped surfaces never have formed, or simply that the trapped surfaces exist for some time and then the dynamics...
Well, my view is that it never forms, but okay, that's... I don't have evidence for it.
Right.
Right.
It just seems to me that since a trapped surface can be defined at one time, and since...
For the actual singularity theory, it's sufficient to just... just define it at one instant of time, and then together with the rest, absolutely, yes,
right.
Right. So, I mean, if this falls, clearly that will have to fail. So, never forms, because if it forms, then the actual theorem kicks in, then the rest follows. And then,
but I'm trying to understand, a trap surface is a surface where I measure the expansion of light rays, it's negative.
But I mean, you have to tell me, what is the observable at infinity? Then we can. Because I'm saying that from infinity, so especially in ADS gravity, the only thing that I can that I can actually measure is really the self-adaption correlation functions, and those ones are going to be very close to the difficult one.
If you wish to use a terminology of solutions and some more complicated gravity theory, and if we're talking in largely classical terms, I think I should be able to ask about things that are not just defined in film.
Well, I think, but I mean, all my answers would, let's say, refer back to, let's say, properties of infinity. So if an asymptotic observer cannot distinguish the one from the other, then it's
Costas, you're just giving a black box description of what's happening. You're telling us at infinity, nothing particularly special seems to happen. Therefore, nothing should happen in space.
So let's let Costas finish.
Yeah, since it's already. Okay, so yeah, that's the last slide. So. So what I'm trying to first of all, I'll show that holography can increasingly be promoted to a very precise framework that can be used to compute field theory properties from geometry and vice versa. And in particular, we discussed how to decode the hologram for asymptotically against cross X geometries. And similar precision holography is also being developed for other gravity gauge theory dualities. So these tools can be used to extract detailed information from phenomenological holographic models and moreover play a key role in understanding black hole physics. So I try to convince you that the idea CFT implies that some form of the Fuzzle proposal should hold, and that holographic techniques can be used to scrutinize and further develop that proposal. So our results for the two-tiered system supports the overall picture, although the detailed correspondence is far more complicated than previously suggested. And lastly, we currently work on trying to understand supersymmetric systems that do have macroscopic horizons, so this would be closer to physical black holes, as well as understanding how generic properties of black holes emerge upon cross-grain and fuzzball geometries. Thank you.
So, because I think that rather than motivating the fuzzball picture, ADS-CFT actually kills it. Because there are theorems that for systems that thermalize, pure states and ensembles are very hard to distinguish. That is, simple observables, one-point function. This is something I wish Mark Fedlitsky were here, because he works on this. It's why it's surprising, but it's actually why statistical mechanics works. And I think certainly one-point functions are simple enough observables that these theorems would apply. So what they would say is that really, if in fact the gauge theory thermalizes, these one-point functions have to be the same in all states. The fact they're not, again, has to do with the fact that this system has a few special states that are, you know, that have special symmetry. Okay, the end.
But you haven't explained why this kills the proposal. So what?
You have to explain why it motivates it, and I explain why it anti-motivates it. That is, I mean, there is nothing that you've shown that. Well, again, if the gauge theory fully thermalizes, and maybe it doesn't in some planar limit or something, but if it fully thermalizes, then again, there are theorems which would show that the generic pure state, which you haven't studied, will not be distinguishable by these one-point functions. And it's not surprising, because again, if I give you a lump of coal and you want to determine whether it's in a pure state or a mixed state, the measurements you have to make are very much more subtle than the ones that you've talked about. Because the ones that you've talked about really just require you to measure one-point function once, rather than all possible endpoint functions, which is what you need to distinguish pure states.
I mean, of course, in this case, it's just, for simplicity, I discuss one-point functions. All the formulas are, let's say, one-point functions in the presence.
Right. But the fact that the one-point functions work means that the theory hasn't thermalized. It actually falsifies ADS-CFT. I mean, if it were true in the strongest sense, it would probably falsify ADS-CFT, because it would mean that the gauge theory couldn't really thermalize. This is non-thermal behavior that you're finding.
But of course, it is no. But that system is very specific, right? Supersymmetric, so it has zero temperature. So the less.
Well, you're right. So, but I mean, but the conjecture I assume is supposed to be meaningful. I mean, you're saying it doesn't apply to finite temperature black holes.
No. I'm saying that the fact that, let's say, the one-point functions in that case very precisely, let's say, map the specific geometry to the specific state, and you could see this from the one-point functions, that's specific to that system. In other systems, you will have to see, to look at, let's say, a higher-point function.
But if all one-point functions are the same, the geometry is probably trivial, right?
So one technical point, not that I disagree with philosophically, but the technical point is I believe the theorem is that the time average of the one-point functions are the same. In other words,
well, it's a pure state, so their state is stationary. I mean, sorry. So this
a
is
generic pure state is not stationary.
Sorry, this is technically stationary pure states. I'm sorry. Excuse me. Yes.
So when I coarse grain the system,
it can still depend on position. Yeah. One-point function can still depend on position. Oh, sorry. I'm not sure.
So when this system is coarse-grained, then clearly one has to, well, let's say, find the same. If I don't find the same behavior, if this coarse-grained doesn't wash out the non-trivial depths, okay, I would be in trouble. But I mean, at the end of the day, unless somebody really demonstrates that upon coarse-graining one really gets black hole properties, then this is, in a sense, the ultimate goal to really. If we can't demonstrate this, then there's not much evidence. But I don't think there is just a single point, a single thing.
Let's thank Costas first.
Yeah.